Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Matthew Longo, who's the author of The Picnic, A Dream of Freedom and the Collapse of the Iron Curtain. This was published in 2024 by W.W. Norton, and it is a lovely read, a beautifully written book that talks all about the end of the Cold War, the reality and porousness of the Iron Curtain, and so much else, including a discussion of freedom. So I'm going to let Matthew tell us all about that. But I want to start out by asking Matthew to tell us a little bit about himself and how he came to this particular project. Hi, Matt.
Hi, thank you. It's really nice to be back, in fact, on your podcast. So this project, I guess like everybody in your audience who is as nerdy as I am, as I presume is most of your audience, understands that a lot of our ideas come from conferences. And I've made this point to non-academic audiences, and they all find it kind of funny. I actually think you will totally identify with what I'm about to say. I was at a conference, in theory giving, or in practice giving a talk on the U.S.-Mexico border. It is a borders conference, and maybe it is as geeky as you'd hope. Maybe it's more geeky than you'd hope, but our borders conferences often take place at borders. This particular conference took place half in Budapest, half in Vienna. Didn't matter. It was just a place. I was very happy to spend time in these cities. But our protocol in the Association of Borderlands Studies, which I'm part of, is to take a day in the middle to go to the border. And it could be a field trip in a researchy way, or it could just be a nice day out in the sun, or so forth. Anyways, I was there. As I said, I worked on U.S.-Mexico. I never thought about Hungary or Austria, anything like that. But I was there at the border, and I met this guy named Laszlo. And he told me a story about what had happened in 89. And I had thought, as a border geek, I had heard every great story about borders, at least every great story that pertains to, like, you know, the Cold War, like the Western world. I understand that not, of course, not every border. But a story like this with such obvious ramifications for geopolitics, and it floored me that I had never heard it. And so I left thinking, like, okay, well, you know, maybe Laszlo was just kind of overstating it a little bit. You know, maybe this is a guy, you know, he's in his 60s. He really liked regaling his battle days in the Hungarian, you know, a pro-democracy revolutionary movement. So I kind of thought, okay, let's take this with a slight grain of salt. But, you know, and then I read into it, and the story kind of got more real and got more interesting. And I, a couple days later, because I'd gotten his email, I wrote to him with just a question, which is I had to know if the people were still alive, because I'm not a historian, and a lot of my work involves interviews and ethnographic work. And I really like the idea of doing a project in memory of 30 years earlier is very attractive, but only if I could really talk to and meet these people. And not only do they exist, he wrote back like, yeah, of course, you know, they all live around the corner. Who do you want to know? Oh, you'll meet everyone. And so it kind of started off that way. So there I was back out in the Hungarian borderlands, you know, 6 weeks later, meeting all these 60-something ex-democracy activists and getting their tales.
And you populate this book with all of them so that the book is really wonderful in terms of getting a sense of who all these people were. You tell the stories through their perspectives in so many ways. And it is, like your previous work, very much an ethnographic study. But also, like your previous work, it gets into the sort of thorny dimensions of what a border actually is and how it works, which is what I really found so fascinating about your previous book. And having lived through 1989, I was really captured by this story that I too did not know anything about. So before we get into all these questions of borders and freedom and all of that good stuff, tell us about the picnic.
Sure. So I also remember 89 very strongly, and I remember the fall of the Berlin Wall. And it's not just you and I that did not know this story. I live now in Europe. I teach at Leiden in Holland. And the number of times I will meet people who are older than myself, who lived in Europe, who were news reading age, and they didn't even know the story. It's quite a special thing. I think in general with history, these events that are adjacent to the more famous event often get lost, right? So everybody remembers the fall of the Berlin Wall. This moment, the fact that it's precipitative makes it interesting. But in the big telling, you know, everybody remembers the event and all the other stuff filters away. So what is the picnic? So you have to imagine in your mind, you travel back in time to the 80s. This is not just the 80s in the West, it's the 80s in the East, which have even less information. But even in the West, I mean, you know, you have to imagine no internet, no cell phones, right? This is a time in which basic information was largely centralized. I mean, you got news from newspapers that were controlled by conglomerates or big powers or, you know, and you're now thinking of yourself on the other side of the Iron Curtain, as my characters are in the story. There was very little information. And you then further position yourself, not just in Hungary in the 80s, but way out in the eastern part of Hungary in a city called Debrecen, where you're a stone's throw from the Romanian border, but more importantly, you're about an hour drive from what is now Ukraine, the Ukrainian border, but then was literally the Soviet Union, right? So the Soviet Union ended, you know, an hour from your house. And these are people for whom, you know, maybe there had been some whispers of change and they knew who Gorbachev was and things like that, but the idea of anything real, of not being communist, anything like that, was unimaginable in their lifetimes. But at the same time, there are people who had grown up in late stage communism, who felt their lives were stifled. They weren't going anywhere. They were not getting jobs. They were not being able to hold down houses or marriages or do anything with their lives. They were young and frustrated and angry. And it's exactly this kind of person, you know, smart and pissed off, that are the great engines of history. And I meet these people who, out in the East, have this one particular wild opportunity to meet the man, so Otto von Habsburg, who would have been the heir of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, had it not folded. And they meet him for a dinner. He comes to give a talk out in Debrecen. And they're at this dinner, and one of these guys, his name is Ferenc, he has this idea. You know what? We shouldn't be talking about interesting ideas of democracy out here in Debrecen, but also in a, you know, fancy hotel receiving this scion. We should do it somewhere meaningful. And his thought is we should do it at the border. But to give you an idea of what his conception was, he really thought the border was like, you know, a line in the sand, and you can get Austrians on one side and Hungarians on the other, and you'd, like, I don't know, throw sausages back and forth or something, or like throw beer across the border and have like a bonfire. And that was the idea. And it was just going to be a big snub your nose to the Iron Curtain, which of course kept them in, right? Because they couldn't travel. And it's a completely insane idea that you would throw the party, even given what they knew. But then if you factor in what they didn't know, which is that the Iron Curtain wasn't just a line in the sand, that it was a often several kilometers wide expanse of gun towers and even mines, nevertheless soldiers and dogs. I mean, most of the mines have been cleared. But, you know, the word most in that sentence is kind of weight-bearing, right? So it's an incredibly dangerous place, an electrified zone of security, let's say. It's completely impossible that you could throw a party in the Iron Curtain. And yet this was the idea. And these guys start to plan it. There's this wonderful moment where they start to try to get other opposition figures interested. And they, of course, fail. Except for this one woman, her name is Maria. She and Ferenc are basically the nucleus of a team. And so, you know what? We're just going to do it. Let's just throw a party. We'll figure it out. And so the first part of the book is trying to map this party. Now, part of why it could even happen is that in addition to the kind of muckraker story, which interested me, because of course I met Laszlo, who was one of these activists. I was kind of interested in the democracy promotion side, but a lot of it is that you also had elites in power. In particular, this, you know, the other figure to introduce into the story is this guy named Miklos Nemeth, who was the last prime minister of communist Hungary. And he was also a reformer and also trying to reclaim Hungarian sovereignty. And therefore, for him, getting rid of the Iron Curtain, and in particular, all the militarization that was, of course, Soviet powered and also monitored, was an ideal for him. So it's not just that the Hungarian government allowed this party to happen, it's that it was also trying to dismantle the Iron Curtain at the same time, and therefore saw this party as like a nice opportunity. You know, let's actually see how far we can go. These guys want to throw a party in the borderlands? Let them. Let's hope the Soviets don't move on them. But if they do, we have a sense of how far we can push things, right? So all these factors get together, this completely insane picnic idea. And I can't overstate this. It's a party. It is a protest created by 20 and 30 somethings where the main idea was to get a bandstand, play music, dance, drink, eat goulash, have a great time. But as this is happening in the most politicized place in the world, it obviously draws everyone's attention. And most importantly, it draws the attention of all the other people in the East Bloc that want to get out. And most notably, East Germans. Because, anybody who's ever seen, you know, a movie like The Lives of Others or one of those kinds of, everyone has an idea of how draconian the Stasi were. An absolutely brilliant film.
For anyone who hasn't seen it. Yes, 100%. I've also been to the Stasi Museum
gorgeous, right? Incredible, but so gorgeous film. But it just gives you a sense, right? So you're in totally, clamped down East Germany. All you hear is that Hungary is starting to reform its border areas. And here we're talking about, at this point, it's June, it's July, it's August 89, which importantly correlates with summer. And so East Germans anyways would go to Hungary as they always had. Hungary is like a, it's a lot warmer. It has this beautiful inland lake called Lake Balaton. Like, it's not like you could go to the Mediterranean, the Caribbean, right? I mean, it's a restricted zone, right? But because it's part of the socialist East, it was an area you could travel to. And it's a country known for, good food and good wine and all these things. Anyways, there were hundreds of thousands of East Germans who would anyways be going for vacation. But this summer, there's this little extra thing, which is that people are hoping or thinking maybe they can get out. And so this combination of these three forces, the Hungarian muckrakers, a very willing Hungarian government, and hundreds of thousands of East Germans all end up convening in the same place in the borderlands. And it leads to basically this big breach, a breach of the border, the largest in the history of the Iron Curtain, but it quite literally the precipitating event that would lead to the fall of the Berlin Wall. So much so that upon reunification, then West German Chancellor, but now unified German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, in the speech at the Bundestag, said that it was in Hungary that the first brick was knocked out of the Berlin Wall, right? So it's really a precipitating event, this border breach.
And from the border breach, essentially, which happens in August, right? This is August of 1989, and it is a party. It's, that's what happened in this sort of borderland space. How does that knocking out of the first brick move to the wall coming down, to the fall of Czechoslovakia, East Germany, Romania, which is another sort of bordering area that was even more draconian than Hungary and so forth?
Yeah. So the event is August 19th, big party. So they were planning on, they were hoping for 1,000 people. I think they were fearing it would just be them with their own beer and no one else. It turns out 20,000 people show up. But the actual party is really, it's just the stage, right? They set the stage for this event. But the event, or at least the breach, is We don't know an exact figure. We think at a low end, about 600, at a higher end, maybe 1,000 people storm the border. The border guards who are supposed to be stopping them, as they had for the entire history of the Iron Curtain, right? This is the most deadly border in the world at that time. See hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people coming at them. They decide to basically let them pass. These were not, in their words, these were not enemies. You know, they had strollers, right? These are people on vacation that are just hoping they can get out. And within 3 weeks, so from August 19th, 89, to September 11th, which is the day that Nemeth, this prime minister, says, okay, just open the border at that point. Once people are crossing illegally, because it was that first event was this breach. It was really a rip of the curtain. But then that night, hundreds more. The next day, hundreds more. We're talking thousands and thousands and thousands of people. They're going through the woods. And you had a particularly, you know, the first part of the story is lovely. This idea that, you know, there's these benevolent border guards that let these refugees pass and all that's lovely. But, you know, 2 days later, someone's shot and killed at the border. It is still a militarized zone. You still have some border guards who are less keen on this whole everything goes willy-nilly thing. And that really spooks Nemeth. You know, it was okay until there was a death. And after that, Nemeth basically says, okay, this can't happen. You can't just have thousands of people. You can't have border guards with guns deciding on their own whether to let people cross them. I mean, this whole thing is not sustainable. So 3 weeks later, he just opens the border. And at that point, we're talking tens of thousands in one day. I mean, cars full of people are just crossing and crossing and crossing, and it's open. It never closes again, right? So at that point, not only are the hundreds of thousands of East Germans in Hungary all leaving, but the wall has lost all of its meaning. It's lost its integrity, right? The whole point of the wall is that it was an uncrossable space. If people could just cross another way, it doesn't do anything. It's lost its power. So more or less overnight, the wall lost any kind of significance. And what they could do was try to close its own borders. But, you know, East Germany was already falling apart. And East Germany sustained itself in part by allowing people these liberties, these small liberties of going on vacation and all these things. It was considered a safety valve for them, like a pressure valve. And once you start to close the border and you keep people in, people start protesting. And so contemporaneously, so again, September 11th is the day of the big opening. In early October are the really big rallies you start to see in East Germany. I mean, things you would never have imagined in East Germany, even, you know, a year earlier or 2 years, forget it. I mean, there's no way. And so much so that then actually the East German government opens the border again to try to get people out, because they realize it's worse to keep people in and have them protest than maybe to get the protesters to leave. And so within the 2 months between September 11th and the fall of the Berlin Wall in November, the whole logic of the security system fell apart. So it is really quite direct.
And this is, I remember the East Germans opening the border as an effort to kind of like, oh, we'll get all the you know, the people who are making trouble out of here, and then we'll be good again. I have vague recollections of that, because right. I thought, then that's an interesting approach to.
Well, it's just so wild. They went from like, you know, basically locking nobody leaves. Like, please get them out, get rid of these protesters, then we'll be fine again. No, of course it's going to fall apart. It was over. It was all over. It's just that, you know, like anything, sometimes you have the pile of hay for a long time and it just takes the match. But the reason the story is so interesting is that this match, not only did it happen in these completely wild circumstances so far away, but all the interesting things about politics, about freedom and authority and about revolution and democracy, all these issues come to a head in this such a real world way. That it's really quite beautiful to have had the experience, the pleasure of spending years looking into it. I mean, I had never had a subject that was both so random and so important in my life. Everything else I've either chosen because it was random or because it was important. The idea that they were going to overlap is serendipitous.
And that's, I mean, it is sort of the tone of your book as well. It that there is a kind of, it's definitely not a sort of a traditional scholarly book. No, I mean, it is a scholarly book, but it's not in the sort of traditional sense. And part of it is, you know, it is oral history. And so you are using the words of the people who actually participated in these events to tell the story. But as you say, it's kind of a serendipitous event. And you tell the story in a kind of serendipitous way, which I found particularly engaging. But, you know, this period of time, also you have these events going on, like Tiananmen Square, which was also sort of connected to, you know, concerns about what was going on in Eastern Europe. And what might happen. So you have these global political sort of concerns and constraints, and then you have a picnic that leads to borders. I mean, and you are a border expert. And so I want to ask you about, you know, how do we think about this Iron Curtain border and also the events that happened to eliminate the Iron Curtain?
Yeah. So let me say two things. I want to, because in the beginning, what you just said, before I take that second bit about the border, about the tone of the book. Yeah. It's so important to me in this book that it's storytelling, because it really is kind of, you know, we all, it's like, you know, you're always fighting the last war. I feel like we're all always trying to undo the damage of our first books, or our first projects. I decided my first book project not to put things in people's voices. I did all these interviews. I spent all this time in the borderlands, and then I distilled it like an academic book into argument. And it was so important to me not to do that, that I just feel really bad that actually I wrote this book that you never hear the thoughts of the border guards, you know, and you don't hear their fears and frustrations and all the lexicon of human emotions, all that's cut out of the book. And this book, I thought, okay, the only thing I'm certain of is that these people are talking themselves. I will narrate, right? There's tons of arguments in the book that I care about and thinkers and all these things. But it was so important to me that at the very least, I wasn't going to ruin that.
Well, right? You didn't.
Thank you. It's such an important point to me, because it is, in some sense, it's obviously not an academic book, because the narrative is foregrounded and the argument is backgrounded, as opposed to the formula for the academic book. Even those that use ethnographic or interview work is still to foreground the argument and filter the narrative into the argument. So methodologically and stylistically, the whole book is different, because the narrative leads. But because of that, there's always a bit of out of controlness of it, right? Like, you are following people's stories, and if you're going to tell them earnestly, you end up kind of stuck with their tangents. You're a little bit hostage to their narrativity, right? The way they want to tell the story. And so there's actually a kind of a tension between my narrative voice, which is always trying to re-anchor the story in the direction I want it to go in terms of the arguments I want to make, and the narratives which go their own way willy-nilly and are completely uncontrollable. And so what I actually like about the book is that tension. I like the go-between of the narrative and the argument. But yeah, that's right. It is really meant to be storytelling. But on the second point about borders, not only are they all connected, so Tiananmen was a really big part of what motivated East Germans to literally risk their lives. Because Tiananmen was June, early June in 89, and East Germans read the news, and it was kind of a trigger moment for them, because they realized, look, it might be risking your life to try the borderlands, which is, again, an insane idea, right? The Iron Curtain was, I mean, we have the only equivalent maybe now of the Iron Curtain is like the DMZ between the Koreans, right? This kind of like absolutely uncrossable no-go zone, and you're going to go with your children, right? Almost all the people I interviewed had kids. It's wild that you would do this. But then you have to think of it in the bigger picture, which is not just that the kids you'd be raising in East Germany didn't have future prospects. not just in terms of freedom, also economically, but also this feeling, look what just happened in China. That's going to happen here. In other words, staying was just as risky as leaving in their minds. Like, and you know, Honecker, who was the East German premier, responded to Tiananmen by saying, you know, basically good on China, right? Good on China for getting rid of those Western provocateurs or whatever, you know.
The term was.
Insane way of thinking about what just happened. And so all of these things are connected. That's right. And actually, that's part of the interesting thing. Also to be a little bit introspective about the way we understood these ideas in the West as an American who grew up with this completely Manichaean view of the world where, you know, it was horrible on the other side of the curtain and the Berlin Wall falls and like freedom reigns. And it's just, I had this completely simple high school education, right? This simple black and white high school education about what the fall of the Berlin Wall signified. And me in New York, Tiananmen Square, some guy in an East German farm village, they're all part of the same web of information, disinformation, ideological maneuvers by states, by schools. All of us were part of this system. And there's a way that now, after the Cold War, we no longer really think in those kind of ideological terms, the idea that we were all part of a system. But I think what's interesting about going back in time is that not only do you have to realize how much ideology played a role in the 80s and in these places, but so did it for us.
Right.
It really was an interesting introspective process learning all this. All the stuff I didn't know. Even Hungary, right? Hungary was a more progressive Eastern Bloc state, right? East Germany, bad guys. Romania, bad guys. Hungary was like this slightly better, more liberalized economy, slightly more free, all these things. We would never have learned that in our Western education, right? I never would have learned that there was like variation behind the Iron Curtain, but also variation that was actually quite powerful and moving, right? There was actually a incredibly, or at least better functioning version of communism with a quasi-liberalized economy. These kind of subtleties were just destroyed in my upbringing, my education. And so it isn't just Tiananmen in East Germany, it's all of us. I think it's all this one big picture. And that was really interesting to kind of rediscover.
Yeah, I mean, I do remember having, I actually traveled into Yugoslavia in 86. And, you know, again, it was like you could go there without a whole lot of hassle. And it was someplace behind the Iron Curtain, but not, as you say, as bad as Romania, or, you know, a lot of the other really bad places. And there was subtle differences, particularly by the time we get to the 80s. Right. And before the curtain falls, that, you know, we have the more Western facing countries that were not as locked down. And we're trying to sort of sort their way out in a certain sense. And I find this, you know, part of what you have done in telling these stories or letting the stories be told by their narrators is you keep also threading together the sort of Cold War mentality with the fact that this happened 30 years ago.
Yeah, right. And actually, to go back to political science, since this is a political science podcast, and a lot of our listeners will be political scientists, this bit about all the whenever we distill stories into argument, any kind of data into argument, what you're doing is you're trying to find supporting bits of evidence. But we all know that we're filtering out the complexity of the world and looking for signals amongst the noise and all these things. Part of what's so interesting about storytelling, and again, this is not the way I had ever written before. I'd never written. Certainly, my first book was the opposite of this, right? You have no experience as a reader of my evidence, except what I tell you, right? I'm the author. I'm the God figure of all the information, and I distill it into an argument. And what's so wild about having the stories lead is it's not only that it forces you to allow the, or lets you allow the reader to judge for themselves what they're actually interpreting. You might completely disagree with the way I process or narrate this material, which I think is actually, from the position of the author, hugely vulnerable, right? I mean, it's hugely vulnerable to think that, like, a person could read this and go, no, that's not what that person meant. I'm interpreting what I think they mean, but I'm also not just saying what I think they mean. I'm giving you what they say, and then I'm saying what I think it means. And so there's a kind of vulnerability that comes from it. But I also think it generates a way more interesting and sophisticated argument, because it keeps me out of saying, well, this book is going to make one claim really well. Actually, it ends up leading you towards a book where you're making 1,000 claims, most of them just scattershot. And then you pull out the one or two things you really want to say, and you hope that the material supports it enough to conclude that. But I really like this feeling of this mixture of transparency and vulnerability that comes from storytelling. I have to think a lot more about what this means for political science, but I definitely leave this feeling like it's not just that I've made – it's not like the argument is lesser because it's second to the storytelling. It's, I think, the argument's better because of the way of the storytelling, and that's something it would take me a little bit of time to figure out why I think that's true.
Yeah, I mean, and again, I so often think myself of politics through narrative. If it be somebody explaining particular ways that they're thinking about an issue or a person, or in my case, I really like to see the narrative arc of a story written or produced by somebody that explains or shows politics. And I think that you're sort of taking that in a different way, but it's the same context.
Yeah, and to give to, in the for full disclosure, so Lily and I have been part of a book project in the past on the Marvel Cinematic Universe. This is a project that Lily led. I just gave a chapter, but it's a very similar feeling, which is that when you analyze a movie, because the movie is public, everybody can see the film, and of course, in the chapter, you also spell out the film. You give the people the terrain on which you have the interpretive battle, you know, fought. But it's a completely different thing when you're dealing with complete public domain information and then analyzing it versus the way most projects happen, which is that the information is held in the hands of the researcher, even if some of it's made public.
Right. And again, I think that this helps people to understand, because our brains often work more effectively, shall we say, in capturing and consuming narrative than looking at sort of legalistic arguments or, you know, sort of general arguments, which is reason, obviously, but they're both sort of presenting arguments in different formats.
On that point, so when I've looked at reviews of my book, it's really interesting how different reviewers, what they think the book is about, which is the opposite of my experience with my first book. My first book was about a thing. It made a claim. It can be right or wrong. But the idea of, like, the question, what is the book about, would never generate different answers, right? Like, it was a very straightforward argument. Here, I'll read a review and I'll think, it's really interesting what that person picked up as, like, the essential strain for them. And that's also been very gratifying.
Well, you're putting the information out there and letting people interpret it on their own as well. But I did want to bring you back a little bit to this question that I have, because the Iron Curtain plays such a giant role in are thinking about the world, our being from the West, from the East, from wherever, that there was this, you know, this very clear border. I mean, I've been to Berlin, I've seen Checkpoint Charlie, you know, which is different than sitting over in Chicago and reading about it. But it was this place in our imagination, as well as this place actually physically. And one of the things that you do in your scholarship is talk about the sort of porousness and mobility of borders. So this was a little bit less of a mobile border, in fact, but it was a kind of mobile border in our imaginations. And you and the people you talk to sort of talk about that.
Yeah, the border in the Iron Curtain days, and I think this filters to this question of information, which is that because information was so standardized and the story was so Manichaean, the border actually was the site of all these narratives. No one had been to the border. No one had crossed the border. You knew about it in a totally narrativized way, and in particular, it filtered through these ideological systems. What that means is whether or not you thought the border was keeping people in or protecting you from bad guys, these narratives were completely life-changing, right? You lived in a narrative structure that the border played a role in. And what happens in those kinds of worlds when nobody has any experience of the border, part of it is just misinformation, like you had with Fedents out in Debrecen, who thought the border was just, you know, like a fence, who just had no information about it. But part of it is that once you get this kind of mythologized version of it, most of the time it's the opposite of the way Fedents saw it, right? It actually gets bigger and bigger. And so as it gets bigger and bigger, it gets more uncrossable. Remember, no one hears any stories of people crossing. All you hear are stories of people dying, right? The ones that get reported. People trying to, some idiot tries to cross the border and gets shot. So over the decades, the border in its mythologized form gets bigger and bigger, like a genie coming out of a bottle. And so it completely structures the worldview of the people because it's not based on some information of, like, you could imagine a statistical register. How likely is it that any potential border crosser would cross this border? You can put any border into that matrix. But they had no such information. There was no idea except the mythologized form. And that's what's so fascinating. So in particular in East Germany, what I really liked about learning about this border, because it was so different than the one I'd studied in US-Mexico, because almost always we think of the border in terms of its permeability or its crossability. And on the one hand, East Germany was just a different model, right? Because so when you think of US-Mexico, the main thing the border is doing is keeping people out, right? The idea is that the barbarians are at the gate, whether it's Mexicans or terrorists or whoever we've, you know, again, the mythologized other that we've created as being this fear. In East Germany, it was the opposite. It was literally to keep people in, and everybody knew that. Certainly by the 80s, everyone knew that. I mean, maybe not in the early 60s. And so the functionality is totally different. But because we have this mythologization, whatever, that's maybe not a great word, that when we think of the border, the thing we mythologize is the thing being kept out, right? It's all about the barbarians. It's the migrant caravan, right? And these kind of things we talk about, these wild stories that get bigger and bigger and more dangerous and all these things that we create in our narrative. What's interesting about East Germany is that the thing the border was doing, the ideological work of the border, was actually strengthening the Stasi. So the Stasi and the border are not separate institutions. Without the border, right, if you could just leave, the Stasi's information gathering has no real value or greatly delimited value if you could just leave.
Yeah.
But the border, because everyone is so scared of anything they're talking about, of any kind of rumor, you would never even go to the border because you're scared the Stasi would see you. So the lack of information about the actual border, the reason it gets bigger in your mind, is entirely based also on the fact that the Stasi and the border play off one another, each getting bigger in the other's shadow or self-image. And so to experience this completely different mythological structure of borders, right, keeping people in and having information be the thing that makes the border bigger, but also the border be the thing that makes the Stasi valuable, allows us then to reflect on our own borders differently and ask what kind of ideological work our own borders are doing. Because we think we live in a world where we can cross freely, where the only thing the border is doing is keeping out the barbarians. Of course that's not true, right? But right. That's the ideological work of the borders to convince you of that fact. Actually, borders are internal to America. They're not just, you know, at the edge of Texas or California. We know there are different kinds of border regimes throughout the country. Border regimes are just as tied to information in America as they are at anywhere else. Moreover, the actual differentiating practice of the border we think of as being citizen barbarian, right? American, Mexican, whatever the way you want to cut the apple. The idea that actually citizens are distinguished by the border. So the poorer you are, the darker your skin, the more you have something shady in your past, even if that shady thing is something incredibly banal, like, you know, you made a phone call to Pakistan one day and now that was entered in some data bank or whatever. So there's all these ways that the mythologization of the border anyways plays upon us also. It's that whereas in the Stasi context, it's obvious. For a lot of us, in our context, it isn't obvious. And that's what's so interesting about a project like this, right? So the learning of the one actually teaches you much about the other.
Yeah, and in the United States, we've always sort of thought about the movement across states as also something that the states are borders and yet also not borders. And in the current regime with regard to abortion access, the mm-hmm. state borders have now become really interesting places.
Well, and to push back on this slightly, so one of the first papers I ever wrote as a little self-plug was that throughout American history, borders have been open or within the states. We're talking about like state borders within, right. within the polity, have been differentially opened or closed based on who you are. It was very normal for states to try to restrict, in particular, the poor from moving in because they don't want them claiming, you know, welfare benefits or any kind of state benefits. So the idea that we had basically de facto systems to make it so that, again, the darker your skin or the poorer you were, the less likely you were to cross was always true. And that's more of a spectral concern, right? I mean, degrees of poorness. Abortion just makes it obvious because, of course, in state A, it's legal, in state B, it isn't. And so because of the binariness of abortion laws or the more – it's not quite true. There's obviously different abortion laws in different states. But the fact that it feels as though states differentiate more clearly in terms of abortion, we now see things that were always there.
Sure.
Right? We never saw them.
But they've now been made clear. I mean, this is famously, of course, the Loving court case where – the couple that was a, quote, mixed race couple in Virginia was thrown out of the state of Virginia. And who knew states could actually throw you out?
Yeah, right. Right.
Exactly.
When we talk about deportation, we talk about leaving America. The idea that you might actually be, quote, unquote, deported. I mean, it's not quite the same word, but from a state.
Yes.
Right.
And barred from reentry, and that these two individuals had, in order to visit their family, had to sneak back into the state of Virginia from Maryland and Washington, D.C. in the 1950s.
What? And interestingly, the only idiom we really have for this, and not to bring it back to cinema, although I think that you and I both like to do this with our arguments, but is the old Western, the idea that like a sheriff would say, I don't ever want to see you in this district again. This kind of is very normal in Westerns. And the idea that like, you know, if you're the bad guy and you're fleeing the sheriff, you know all you have to do is get to state lines and the sheriff can't follow you you're free.
Of course.
Right? And so this idea that like people are differentially admitted or not admitted in jurisdictions and rules, they were always there. But, you know, Westerns are kind of fun fiction. But when it comes to abortion, it's suddenly not fiction or fun.
Exactly. Exactly. So, Matt, now that you've written about the borders in the United States and Mexico and how they exist in all kinds of places, and you've written about the Iron Curtain border, what's next on the docket?
Oh, God. Oh, I have no idea. Okay. Before I ever started on the U.S.-Mexico border, I had spent quite a long time working on travel restrictions in the West Bank. And I really thought the natural next book project would be to go back to the West Bank and look at checkpoints, but also the wall between, you know, Israel proper and the settlements and the West Bank. And so much so that I actually went and procured a grant in – the summer.
Before October, shall we say.
And I'm not sure that's going to happen. So that was the only answer I had, which seemed good 8 months ago, and now doesn't seem like something you'd really hang your head on. So I don't know. I'll have to go back to the drawing books. I'm not sure about borders, though. I really think that one of the revelatory bits about this for me is actually, whereas my first book really was about borders, this was kind of halfway or equal between borders and migrants and refugees. And I always wanted to move in that direction. I mean, since I moved to Leiden, I've been teaching a seminar on migration, and it's obviously related. But I don't think I really understood when I started embarking on borders how different the subjects were. In the sense that, like, somehow the border and the border crosser seem obviously conceptually linked. They're kind of not. Actually, you really, when you study just the border, you really only encounter the border crosser at the moment of crossing. And so in their whole journey, the whole story of mobilities and migration, you really can only look at one little, you know, instant. And so I was quite ignorant of migrants and refugees as a subject throughout my first book writing process. And because this book is obviously all about refugee stories, right? I found that really moving and interesting, and it's really taken me in so many different directions. And so I don't know. I mean, the idea of talking more about border crossing and less about borders, I think would kind of also be a way that could go. But I don't know.
Well, I look forward to the next book.
Nice to see you.
Okay. Sounds good. I want to thank you, Matthew Longo, for joining me today to talk about The Picnic, A Dream of Freedom and the Collapse of the Iron Curtain, published by W.W. Norton in 2024. I assume one can buy this at the W.W. Norton website and other brick and mortar
bookstores.
And in bookstores, bookstores where you shop.
Exactly.
So thank you for joining me today, Matt. It's been great to talk to you.
It's really been a pleasure.